Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Marriage Fitness with Mort Fertel. This is Mort Fertel, and this is your Q&A teleconference. Let me begin by offering a brief explanation as to what a Q&A teleconference is. So all the other teleconferences in your program are what I call teleseminars. And on the evening of those teleseminars, I come with a very specific agenda, certain principles and practices that I feel are crucial for every marital situation. And admittedly, there's no opportunity for you to interact with me, to ask me questions about what I'm presenting, or to ask me questions about what I'm not presenting, but what you feel is important to your situation. So those teleconferences are a monologue. Tonight is the exact opposite. It's not a monologue. It is a dialogue. I come with no agenda whatsoever. I have no idea what we're going to discuss tonight because you set the agenda. You decide it's going to be based on your questions and based on how you explain your circumstances. So if you have a question at any point during the teleconference, just press star 6. That'll cue you up for a question. If I do click on you, if I do choose you to ask a question, I do ask that you follow an important rule of the teleconference, and that is, please start with your question. Again, if I call on you to ask a question, please start with your question. I know from experience that people's tendency is to start by giving me all sorts of background information about their spouse, their marriage, the other man, the other woman, whatever the case may be. Sometimes it seems like people could go on forever, and I wonder if there's a question in sight. I don't mean to sound insensitive. I know there's a lot of pain in your heart. I know there's a lot on your mind. But keep in mind, this is not a private session. It's a Q&A teleconference. So you provide the Q, and I provide the A. That doesn't mean we won't have a chance to talk. We will, but start with your question, and then allow me to probe you for the background information I feel I need in order to answer your question. You'd be amazed at the information I don't need, which you might otherwise take our time to provide. You'd also be amazed at the information that I do need, which you might not think to offer. So I hope at this point in the program you trust me and you realize that no matter what you're going to ask, chances are good I've answered the question a few thousand times. That doesn't mean I don't feel your pain. Doesn't mean I'm not on my toes here. I am. But I just have a big responsibility to many, many people on the line, and I simply cannot allow any one person to monopolize our time. So again, if you come on the line to ask me a question, please start with your question. I do want to mention that as you might be able to hear in my voice, I'm struggling with a really bad cold today. I'm pretty sure I have the energy to do this teleconference. That's why I really didn't want to cancel it. I know how much you're all looking forward to it and needing answers to your questions. But I may have to push the mute button a few times over the course of the evening. I'll try to save you from coughing in your ear or sneezing in your ear, or if I have to blow my nose or something, you'll just excuse me for a couple of seconds while I put you on mute and take care of what I need to take care of, and then I'll be right back. I hope it doesn't happen, but I just want to give you that heads up. We're getting lots of questions in the office about Mimi Daniel, David Rispoli, and Elise Hurtado. Questions are like, who are these people? What's my relationship with them? As you probably know, these are the three other marriage professionals that work for me and are available to you for extra private one-on-one sessions. So let me explain what's happening here since we're getting so many questions. So many of you have private sessions or full-day intensive house calls scheduled with me, but a lot of you want extra one-on-one help and either don't want to use me for some reason or can't afford my fees. And so that's why I've hired David, Mimi, and Elise to be available to you. Their fees are dramatically less than mine, and they're much more easily available. It's easier to schedule with them as well. I picked them, you should know, because they share my values. So if you feel a certain set of values coming across the plate here, you resonate with them, and you want to make sure you're talking to somebody that shares those values, you can count on David, Mimi, and Elise for that. I also picked them because they have a tremendous amount of experience dealing with marital crisis situations. Not just marital situations, which is typical for a marriage counselor or therapist, but really marital crisis situations, which is what most of you are dealing with. And it would be an understatement to say that they are familiar with the Marriage Fitness program. They are all certified marriage fitness professionals. I trained each of them myself. We conduct ongoing training to keep our tools sharp. And you can count on them providing comparable advice that you would get from me. So if we keep their calendars in my office, if you want to schedule extra private one-on-one sessions with David, Mimi, or Elise, whether they're full-day house calls or phone sessions, you can contact my office and we can help you with that. Okay, so I hope that answers everyone's questions. If you have any others about that, feel free to be in touch with my office. Okay, if I do call and you ask a question, also give me your name first just so I can address you, your first name, that is. And let's begin.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, my name is Jamie.
Okay, Jamie, good evening.
So my question is, how, or is there hope if you're dealing with someone who is a compulsive liar?
Okay. So the truth is that I could have started answering your question after the word hope. I really didn't need you to finish the sentence. I didn't want to be rude, so I was happy to allow you to finish the sentence. But I didn't need you to. And, of course, everybody on the line might ask a somewhat similar question, but finish the sentence differently after the word hope. It really doesn't matter how you finish the sentence. In other words, hope is not an objective matter. It's subjective. Hope is not a function of your circumstances. It's a function of how you, as a person in the circumstances, behave. I have seen situations, many situations, where you look at the circumstances and you might think, this is simple. This is no big deal. This is one of the easiest cases. And yet the couple ends up crashing and burning and getting divorced. And I've also seen plenty of situations where the drama and the trauma of the mess and all the complications and the betrayal and the infidelity and the, you know, like you name it, you know, I've seen it. And yet many times in those situations, it seems like it's hopeless. It seems like, how could a couple ever come back from this? And yet, they do come back from it, and they succeed to reconcile. And why is that? How could somebody with a seemingly simple situation fail, and somebody with a complex situation and traumatic situation succeed? Because again, whether or not there's hope in your situation is not an objective matter. It's not a matter of you or me looking at your circumstances. My husband's a compulsive liar. My wife is having an affair. Again, you can finish the sentence however you like. It really doesn't matter. Whether or not there's hope is not a function of the circumstances. It's a function of how you, in your circumstance, behave. There's lots of reasons why that's the case. I mean, first of all, the first sort of support that I offered for that was just to explain to you that just experientially what I've seen, I just have, you know, many data points to support and to prove that. Let me also offer, besides a data point, an explanation that might make some sense. The reason why one of the reasons why your circumstances is not so much going to determine your outcome as much as your effort in the circumstance is because the outcome of your situation, any relationship for that matter, is much more a function of how you conduct yourself in the future than it is how you conduct yourself in the past. You're all right now feeling very weighed down by the negativity of the way you and your spouse have behaved in the past. Jamie is dealing with a husband who lies a lot. I think you called him a compulsive liar. I'm not sure exactly what that means, and I don't mean to sound ignorant. I've certainly heard the terminology a lot. I just don't agree with what it means. I should say I don't agree with what the term suggests. The term suggests that the person has no control over whether or not they're telling the truth. And that is just simply not true. Your husband does have control and does have a choice about whether or not he tells the truth. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, but I am sure that one of the reasons why he's lying a lot in your marriage is because of the circumstance that you're contributing to in the marriage. I'll just give you an example. I don't know, I'm not saying that this is exactly what's going on in your marriage. It may be, it may not be. It's just an example of a dynamic that a person can create that often leads somebody to lie more frequently than they otherwise would have. So sometimes people have very exacting expectations of their spouse. And their spouse feels incredibly burdened by these expectations that they should do certain things in a certain way at a certain time. And they feel controlled. They feel burdened by these expectations. They don't like it. They don't want it. They know it's not right. And the natural state of a human being is to want to be free. Sometimes people like this, though, are conflict avoiders. And they don't know how to confront their spouse in a healthy way about these negative expectations and about how they're feeling controlled. And so instead of confronting them, they basically hide. They won't be compliant with the expectations, but they'll try to hide their, quote, misbehavior. I put it in quotes because it's misbehaving according to your expectations. And they lie about it because they're conflict avoiders that can't confront you, and they're not willing to be compliant. So they behave in ways that are outside the bounds of your expectations, and they're not willing to be transparent about it. It's just an example. But in 99% of the cases, people don't lie in relationships exclusively because they're liars. They lie in relationships because both people are contributing to a situation that's leaving them vulnerable to lying. And the question is, what's your role in that? How have you contributed to that? And what could you do differently so that the circumstances in your marriage make it less likely that your spouse lies? Here, I'll give you an example inside sort of a different topic. You may have heard me talk about this in the program elsewhere. But, okay, so when a person has an affair, let's just quickly say, and I'll agree, this will take 2 seconds, that it's wrong, right? It's wrong. They broke their vows. It's an act of moral bankruptcy. They shouldn't have done it. They betrayed the relationship. Okay, there's no excuse. There's no justification. It's wrong. They had an affair. Okay, fine. We can all agree to that in 2 seconds. But now here's a little bit more of a challenging idea, but nonetheless just as true. And that is that affairs don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in the context of a broken marriage. In other words, affairs don't lead to broken marriages. Broken marriages lead to affairs. And if that's true, which it is, people in happy, fulfilling, satisfying marriages don't have affairs, then it must be that both people contributed to the broken marriage. I've never seen a situation where there's not dual responsibility. And if both people contributed to the broken marriage and the broken marriage led to the affair, then in a little bit of an interesting way, both people are responsible for the breakdown in the marriage, for the affair. Now, don't misunderstand. If your spouse betrayed you, I'm not letting them off the hook. I'm not justifying what they did. Okay, I already covered that. That took 2 seconds. That doesn't require an explanation. We can all agree to that. What's a little bit more difficult to swallow, it's a bitter pill, but it is true nonetheless. And if you have been betrayed, it's an important truth to recognize, and it's a valuable one, and that is that if your spouse strayed, it is partly because, it's not giving them an excuse, but nonetheless, it's partly because you have contributed to a marriage that was unfulfilling, that was unsatisfying, and that was broken. And that put them in a situation where they were vulnerable to making a mistake. And so, is there hope? That question is not really a question that you should be asking me, because it's not a question that I or anybody else can look at your circumstances and objectively say, because you're dealing with this, this, and this, yes, there is hope, or no, there is hope. No, that's not the way it works. Is there hope is a question you should be asking to yourself. You get to answer that question, not by saying, yes, there's hope, or no, there's hope. You get to answer that question by how you deal with this situation, how you behave, how you act, the choices you make over the next 6 months, let's say, are your answer to that question. If you behave in ways that give your marriage a chance to heal, then you've answered the question. Yes, there is hope. Because whether or not your marriage turns around has everything to do with what you do over the next 6 months. It has to do with how you behave and how you behave in the future, not what's occurred in the past. If, on the other hand, you say to yourself, no, there's no hope, and therefore I'm defeated, and therefore what's the point of employing any of these principles and practices? Well, then you've answered the question. There's no hope. But understand, there's no hope not because objectively there's no hope. There's no hope because you're not doing anything, because you don't think there's no hope. Sometimes, you know, sometimes I have these private sessions, and somebody will say to me, you know, Mort, I made this appointment a couple of weeks ago. I was really looking forward to talking to you when things are different, but now I really feel like this session is going to be a waste. I don't even know if I really want to talk to you because such and such has happened and there's no hope. And, okay, you might as well tell me, like, what do you think? You know, is there any hope? Because I don't think so. And my response is, no, I agree with you. You're right. There's no hope. What? You're supposed to tell me there is hope. No, but you don't think there's hope, so there's no hope. If you don't think there's hope and you're defeated and you're not going to do anything to try to change the situation, then there's no hope. But understand, there's no hope not because there's really no hope. It's just because you don't think there's any hope. So is there hope is not an objective matter that you ask me and I analyze your situation and answer. Is there hope is a question that's answered by you, not verbally, but by your behavior over the next few months. If you respond by employing these principles and practices and behaving in ways that are known to turn marriages around, then you have answered the question, and the answer is a resounding yes. There is hope. Okay.
Hi, Mort. My name is Chase.
Okay, Chase. Good evening.
I was wondering how long it should be before we even start to approach our issues again. We've put them away, but we're looking at time and a time frame.
Yeah. Okay, good question. It's not a question that I can answer giving you a date or weeks or months, but I can give you some parameters that I think would be helpful. It really depends. It's a judgment call that you and your wife have to make. You have to ask yourself, have we made enough progress? Have we built enough goodwill? Do we feel much more of a connection? And are we going to approach these problems and issues with each other in mind, being sensitive, being loving, and really wanting to improve things, not wanting to beat each other up and complain and point the finger? So, you know, you really have to – by the way, let me just back up for a second and thank Chase for the question and remind all of you of something that is often overlooked. An important word in the program is temporarily. In other words, I advise that we put aside the problems and the issues temporarily. And often that word gets overlooked, and I get accused of, oh, Mort just wants us to sweep everything under the rug. We're never going to talk about it. We're never going to resolve it. No, that's not what I said. That's not the advice. Chase is asking a good question. He picked up on that word temporary, and he's asking, okay, what's temporary mean? Like, when can we, you know, address some of these problems and issues? So, again, I can't give you weeks or months or a date. It's a judgment call. Also, let me point out that usually in a marriage there are multiple issues and problems. And you might answer the question differently depending on the issue or the problem. You might get to a point in the situation where you've built up enough goodwill and you're ready to deal with problem ABC. But you're not ready to deal with problem XYZ. That requires more time, more investment, more progress, and maybe it's months later that you deal with that. Another point, if you're feeling insecure about making the judgment call, you might want to consider inviting a neutral, objective, unbiased third party to learn a little bit about your situation, speak to you and or your wife, and weigh in on what they think would be good timing. I mean, I do that sometimes with people in session, as does David, Mimi, and Elise. They'll say, you know, yeah, I think you can handle this conversation now, given where you're at, or no, I think you should hold off. That's going to be disastrous. Next point. If you should exercise judgment that says, yes, let's try to deal with this problem or issue, whether it's with or without additional counsel, you can enter that conversation, and you don't have to follow through with it. If you sense at any point in the conversation that this is not going well, then you can pull the plug on it, and you can just say to one another, you know, look, this is not going as we hoped. This is not feeling right. I think we need more time. And you can pull the plug on the conversation and give it more time. Next point, better late than early. When in doubt, give it more time. The last thing you want to do is try to deal with one of these problems and issues before you're really ready, and it ends up setting you back. There's very little to no harm or damage by spending more time employing the principles and practices, making a connection, building goodwill, getting closer, having a nice time together, spending more time together, and leaving the problems and the issues on the side for a little bit longer. I understand that you want to get them resolved. You might want to talk about them. There could be some things that need to be discussed. But it's not the end of the world if you're making progress and doing well to continue to do that for a little longer. So those are just some, again, I apologize that I'm just not able to answer with a number of days or months, but I hope I've given you some kind of parameters that you can use to exercise good judgment. Okay, onward.
Hi, this is Eric.
Okay, Eric, good evening.
Good evening. I'm on the Lone Ranger track, and after a talk charge a few weeks back, my wife suggested a weekend trip away, just the two of us, which I jumped on and booked. It's coming up here in about a week and a half. Things have gone south.
Wow, it must have been some talk charge.
It took me by surprise. I was employing some principles, and it, things like you said, it got better, but then it got worse and way worse. So we're on the Lone Ranger track. She since accelerated her emotional and possible, likely physical affair, and now only wants to talk to divorce with me. I've convinced her to still go on the trip as friends. My question is, how do I act if and when she's texting her affair partner or tries to bring up divorce, even though we've we've kind of agreed I'm not going to push reconciliation and she's not going to push divorce. If that comes up, how do I act and keep the goodwill?
Yeah. So those are two completely separate questions. I'm happy to answer both of them, but I, you know, they're really very different. So if I'm sorry, I didn't get to the mute button fast enough. So if she's texting, or you think she's texting her affair partner, I would suggest that you ignore it. There's really no, when I say ignore it, I mean, you can't ignore it in your heart. You can't ignore it in your mind. It's, you know, it's disgusting. It's hurtful. It's a betrayal. It's upsetting. Okay, I'm not advising you how to feel. I can't advise you how to feel. Feelings are natural and spontaneous. What I can advise and what you can choose are your choices, your behaviors, how to respond. And I would respond by doing or saying nothing, because think about it. Is there any way you're going to be able to respond to that that would be helpful and productive? I mean, you could scream and yell and rant and rave, and you'd feel better for a moment because you'd be like, okay, I got you, you know, you're wrong, and I, you know, made you feel bad. You might be able to do that, but that's not productive. You know, that's just doing something that feels good in the moment. But as I've coached you in this program, as you heard me talk about elsewhere, you want to be very careful not to get seduced by what feels good this week or this moment, but instead to keep your eye on the target. You know, as you've heard me say before, my job is to get you from where you are to where you want to be 6 months from now. And you want to be behaving now in ways that maximize that likelihood. So there is no possible response to her texting her affair partner that could be productive in terms of the healing and reconciliation. So just don't go there. Also, I want to say something I deeply believe in, but I know that doesn't seem to resonate with many of you. I just know from previous experience, and that is that, you know, I think we're responsible for giving people the benefit of the doubt. You know, when she's texting, you don't know who she's texting. I mean, it could be anybody. Now, I know you think it's the affair partner, and maybe it is even likely that it's the affair partner, but maybe it's not. And how do you know? And I just think that we're better people and we're better in our relationships when we give people the benefit of the doubt, assume the best, not the worst, and treat people like they're doing the right thing. And I think then the result of that is they become more likely to do the right thing and our relationships are healthier. Next question. If she decides if she tries to bring up the conversation about divorce, so here, your response, I'm going to be brief on this because this I do answer this question elsewhere in the program, but it's such an important topic, I think it's worth repeating. But I'm going to be brief. If you're asking the question, you obviously didn't get to this section of the program, which is no problem, it's no rush. But if this intrigues you, what I'm going to say here, you'll get a more extensive answer as you continue to go through the program. But basically, if your wife tries to bring up the topic of divorce, your response should be that you can't discuss this with her. And that you're a married man, you're committed to your wife and your family, and it would be a violation of your values to do anything that would contribute to the demise of your family. And to discuss the divorce is a contribution to that demise. You know, to discuss the divorce process is essentially you participating in the process of getting divorced. And your position should be, you know, I can't do that. It's a violation of my values. And now, you can say to your wife, look, don't misunderstand. I'm not trying to control you. I can't control you. You know, this is America, and, you know, if you want to divorce me, you can. But your message to her should be, don't ask me to help you. Don't ask me to discuss it with you, because I can't do it. I can't have that on my conscience. I can't have that on my record. I can't have that as an example to our children. And when you take that position, by the way, let me first say that I think you should take that position because it's the right thing to do. It's as simple as that. You should take that position because I think those really should be your values. And because I want you to keep your soul clean, so to speak, and not participate in something so destructive as discussions that plot the demise of your marriage. So you should do that because it's the right thing to do, period. But now that I've said that and you understand that, let me point out that tactically speaking, the unintended consequence of taking that position is that I do think you get two tactical advantages. Now, I apologize for the repetition, but I just want to say again that I'm not advising you to take that position because of these two tactical advantages that I think you gain. I'm advising you to take that position because it's the right thing to do. It's the end of the story. But I'm just commenting, and I think you might be interested, that there are two tactical advantages. Number one is that you transfer the full burden of responsibility of the divorce process logistically onto your wife. And it's a burdensome process, especially if you don't share in it. You know, she'll end up feeling like she's dragging a dead body through this process. It takes much longer. It's much more arduous. It's much more difficult. She would like nothing more than for you to cooperate and participate so the whole thing can go smoothly. I mean, people in your wife's shoes, they often try to convince their spouse to go to mediation, you know, let's make this quick and cheap and da-da-da-da. Forget it. That's consistent with their agenda, but it's in conflict with your agenda, and you should not cooperate or participate in that. The second tactical advantage, and this is more important, is that it transfers the full burden of responsibility onto her conscience. In other words, what your wife wants more than anything is to have a partner in her crime. She wants to be able to say to herself, the children, the world, yeah, we are getting divorced. We are speaking to a mediator. We are splitting up the assets. We are talking about custody. We. You know, if you're going to do something wrong, people want company. And that helps ease their conscience. How bad could it be if he, she is joining me? But this is one of the rare occasions when I recommend to people that they abandon their spouse. Leave them completely alone when it comes to this topic. She should feel completely isolated from you when it comes to this topic, that you're not there, not available, not something. It would be like, imagine she invited you to join her in a plot to murder your neighbor. You wouldn't have anything to do with it. And so too here. She's inviting you on a plot to murder your marriage, and you shouldn't have anything to do with it. Let's go on.
Hi, Mort. This is Lynn.
Good evening, Lynn. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Thanks. So my understanding, I've listened to a lot of the questions on the site, and I've, you know, done all of Marriage Fitness and I'm working through the program. But anyway, it seems to me like you advocate not confronting or asking your spouse about their affair. And to me, that seems disrespectful of yourself and also dishonest to go around and pretend like nothing's going on, like they're not doing anything. And I have been seeing a counselor because I haven't told anyone except for her and my my church leader. And she is telling me that I need to ask him the question, are you having an affair? And she's coached me through a very gentle process of owning my own contribution to this and all of that.
I love this question, and I wish we had 3 hours to dissect this and go through every piece of what you're saying, but we don't. So let's see. How can I do this efficiently? First of all, your counselor is coaching you to tactfully engage your husband in this conversation. I encourage you to ask your counselor the following question, and I'd like an answer to the following question from you as well. And that is, okay, Mrs. Counselor, can you explain to me how engaging in this conversation is going to help me achieve my objective? Let me remind you, my objective is to reconcile my marriage. I think that's your objective. That's why you're in this program, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal. That's what we're trying to get to. Can you explain to me, using simple logic, not a bunch of psychobabble, just simple logic, how this contributes to that objective? I want you to answer that question, and you see if the answer is satisfying. And
I know what she'd say.
Okay, fine. And I want to know what you think also. So tell me what she would say. Go ahead.
Okay. So she talks a lot about imago therapy, which has a lot of similarities to what you teach. And I've read a lot of the book, Getting the Love That You Want. And she says that we need counseling so that we can work through this.
I'm sorry, but that strikes me as ridiculous. Your husband doesn't want counseling. He's having an affair.
Yeah.
That has a 0% chance of influencing him to counseling. Your husband's having an affair. You're kidding me, right? This counselor has to be kidding. That conversation is going to result and inspire him to go to counseling? Good luck. And I don't understand the logic behind it. I mean, I can just tell you experientially that I've never seen it, but also just as a logically speaking, you know, logically thinking person, I don't get the line of thinking there. I don't understand, you haven't explained, and I don't think your counselor can explain either, how that conversation could potentially lead to your husband being excited about going to counseling with you. I think you're dreaming. What else would you say or would she say that in terms of how this could be helpful? Is there anything else, or was that the main thing?
Well, that's the main thing.
That's the main thing. That's incredibly weak. Let me explain to you what if you did this. Let me explain to you, and I don't need a lot of time to explain this because I think it's self-evident. Let me explain to you some of what's going to happen if you have this conversation. Your husband is going to be caught. And he's going to get defensive. He is either going to lie to you, and let's just take these one at a time, okay? How do we feel about people that we have lied to or feel compelled to lie to? I don't want to be anywhere near them. They make me feel bad about myself.
But that's what he does all the time. And that's what I feel like I'm doing to him by pretending that this doesn't exist.
So now hold on. No, let's go slow one at a time. I realize that was one of the things you said before, but and we'll get there, I hope. But before we get there, let me just point out: it may be that he's doing it all the time, but if you confront him, that is one choice that he has. If he makes that choice, I want you or your counselor to explain to me how that moves the needle towards healing and reconciliation. I want to suggest that it moves the needle in the wrong direction. The more he, you know, if he lies to you about it, so he doesn't want to be any, he's not going to want to be a part of that. Also, the other thing is, he has the possibility to come clean. So now he feels like, oh, this is unforgivable. This is unforgivable. I mean, look what I've done. It's over. I feel about 1 inch tall. I have no emotional leverage in this relationship. She's right. She caught me. I'm wrong. Now, what do you think a person is going to do with that feeling? It would take a spiritual giant to come in that situation, to come to you and say, oh, honey, I'm wrong. I blew it. I'm remorseful. I want to seek your forgiveness, and I'm going to stop. I kind of doubt your husband's that spiritual giant, given the way you're telling me he's behaving.
Mm-hmm.
And so his other alternative is to fall back into the arms of a woman who's making him feel good. Now, what's he going to pick? So, again, this kind of advice kind of infuriates me, to be honest, because I think that it's very easy to give this kind of advice to somebody in your situation, and generally people in your situation get excited about this kind of advice. Because it makes you feel a little better in the short term. Yeah, he can't get away with this. Yeah, I'm going to confront him. Yeah, I don't feel good about the fact that he thinks that I don't know. I know he's lying. And I'll feel better if he knows that I know. And you know what? If you confront him tonight, this week, you will feel better. But as I said once before, and I'll say it again, keep your eye on the target. Don't get seduced by things that you could do this week that'll make you feel better, but that'll set you back in terms of the possibility of healing and reconciliation. Do the things that might not necessarily feel good, but will position you for ultimate healing and reconciliation. And I think this is an example of that. I want to address a couple of other things. You said I can't spend too much time on this, although, again, I'd love to have hours. It's just such a fascinating topic and question. But I want to address quickly a couple of other things. So I think that you said that you think you're lying. I don't understand that. You're not lying.
Well, it's deceitful to pretend like I am.
You're not pretending.
Like I don't know anything.
You're not pretending. Why are you pretending? What are you pretending? You know. You know something. What does it mean you're pretending? What action are you taking that is pretending anything?
It feels fake to be all because he.
I think it's the way you're looking at it. It's the way you're looking at it, Lynn. See, you're using words that are influencing your perspective, fake, lying. I don't know if your counselor put these words in your head or your friends or whatever, but you're not lying. Lying is when I say something that's not true. You haven't said anything that's not true. What about when, let me ask you a question. Do you have children?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What?
Yes, I do.
Okay, did you tell them that your husband's having an affair?
No.
Why are you lying to your children?
I'm withholding information.
Exactly. And you know what? You're a good mother. You're smart. That's not lying. That's smart. So if you're withholding that information from your children, which is exactly the right thing to do, we won't get into the reasons, but you're doing the right thing. So why is it lying? Why is it not simply being smart and withholding information from your husband? Of course, that was rhetorical. The answer mm-hmm. to the question, it is smart. And it's not lying. You're not lying. And deceitful? deceitful. Let's see. If I go to a wedding, and sometimes brides, you know, they use hairstylists and makeup artists that they've never used before, and they go, like, all out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, it works. And sometimes they come out, and it's like, oh, my God. Like, what did they do on this special day? They should have tried this person before, you know. And so, you know, there they are, and you're wishing them, you know, good luck and congratulations. And do you also whisper in their ear? Oh, by the way, you know, I just have to be honest and tell you, you look terrible. Like, who did your makeup? No. Like, you would say to that bride, you look beautiful. You're the most beautiful bride I ever saw. And that would be the truth, with a capital T. So, it's, you don't want to zero in on one particular value, let's say truth, and then sort of obsess about it at the cost and the expense of other considerations and values. So there's a lot more going on here than just, you know, whether or not you're, you know, who, there's much more going on here than just, like, who knows what. And I don't think that you're looking at this issue of deceit and honesty in as full way as you could. I don't think there's anything deceitful. I would not, you know, advise you to lie to your husband, but I don't see that you're doing that. I have to address one other issue quickly that you brought up. I love this topic, too. Again, I wish I had much more time on all of these. But you mentioned a big word, a big concept. I think the word you used was respect, right? Was that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you explain what you meant by that? Who is not being respected? You?
Well, I think there's some of it going on in both of us. Like, I've read James Dobson's Love Must Be Tough, and he says that with it's specifically about affairs and infidelity, and he says that both spouses are disrespecting each other, and it's full of a marriage full of disrespect, and that many times the spouse that was betrayed is maybe, I don't know if he uses this word, but weak, and their spouse who has the affair does not respect them at all. And so acting, you know, like you're groveling after them will just drive them away and lose the chance to reconcile the marriage because it just gets tired and worn out. He says has a lingering death. That's what he calls it.
Look, Dobson has some great stuff, but I don't agree with that point at all. I don't agree with that point at all. He goes on to say that if you, you know, I don't consider being loving. I don't consider taking initiative to try to connect with my wife groveling. And, again, words matter, and words influence people's perspective, and when you position loving initiative using the term groveling, you've just taken something that is a blessing, you're just taking something that is an asset, and you've described it in a derogatory way. And I don't like that, and I don't think it's right. And he goes on to say, by the way, that you know, that if you don't take that initiative and you apply this quote tough love, you know, that somehow that's productive. Really? Again, I would challenge anybody, including Dobson, to first of all show me the data points, because I've been involved in thousands of situations and I never see that. And number two is, can you just explain to me the logic there? Just explain to me the logic. My wife, God forbid, is having an affair. She's madly in love with some other man. There's a marital history between us that is a disaster. And I'm going to put distance between me and her, and that somehow is going to result in her leaving him and coming back to me? Really? How does that work? I mean, really? I mean, can anybody explain to me anything reasonable or logical that puts together those thoughts, those ideas? I don't see it. It doesn't work that way. Your spouse is having an affair, I'm speaking to everybody now, because there's something terribly broken about your marriage. And if you're not taking tremendous initiative to try to fix that, then nothing will change. Your marriage has a certain trajectory. And, you know, it's like Newton's law of physics, right? Once things are set in motion, unless something interferes with it, it's going to continue in that direction. These situations don't change because of luck. They don't change because of magic. They don't change because, you know, lightning strikes. They change because you change, and you get in there and take initiative that affects the dynamics in the relationship. Also, when your spouse is having an affair and you just kind of get out of the way and don't do anything, it gives license to them to continue doing what they're doing. Remember, your husband's mistress doesn't think of herself as a mistress. I know that's hard for us to appreciate and understand because she is a mistress. She's having a relationship with a married man, but she doesn't think so. He's convinced her that he's available, and she's convinced herself that she's involved with a available man and that they have a future together. And the more out of the way you are, the less initiative you take, the more you play right into her story. But let me get back to the, I thought when you first asked the question that your point about respect was more like self-respect.
So yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to just offer a word on that, because this is a really important point, because many of you are in the Lone Ranger track, and you're not being treated nicely. You're being betrayed, like in the case of Lynn. You're being lied to. You're being neglected. You're not being treated well. And that's not right, and I understand that that doesn't feel good. But self-respect, look at the term. It comes from the self. My dignity is not a matter of how you treat me. It's a matter of how I treat you. So nobody can take my dignity or self-respect unless I give it to them. And I'm not willing to do that, ever. And so I find it ironic in these situations when people say that, my counselor's telling me I have no self-respect. I would, Lynn, I have a message for you. I have enormous respect for you. I think you're an amazing woman. And I'm not being disingenuous. I hardly know you, but let me tell you what I do know. I know your husband is betraying you, and nonetheless, you're making a Herculean effort to try to keep your family together and reconcile your marriage. You're being true to your vows in a very difficult situation. I have tremendous respect for you. And your husband, on the other hand, is morally bankrupt, behaving like an animal. And he's an embarrassment to your kids and your family. So my message to you is the exact opposite of the message you're getting from your counselor, which is that you should have tremendous respect for yourself. And unfortunately, it's your husband who's lost his dignity. And so I really encourage you to draw your sense of dignity and self-respect, not from how people treat you, but from how you treat them. And if you're not doing that, if your self-respect is dependent upon how everybody else treats you, then you're always going to be vulnerable. And I think that your error is in where you're drawing your dignity and self-respect from. I want to apologize to everybody for taking so much time with Lynn's question, but there really were so many different pieces of the question. I felt like I was answering like five questions in one. And it's just, you know, it was a great question. It brought up a lot of important topics, and I hope everybody, and Lynn, you too, I hope you really benefited from it. Sorry, I can't resist. One more point. The other thing that I think we can all learn from Lynn's question, and Lynn, the other thing I think you should also be careful about, is I admire you for getting help from me, from your counselor, and from books that you're reading. But be careful. It can get very confusing when you get conflicting messages from conflicting professionals. I really encourage, this is one of the reasons why I, you know, created this program to be so comprehensive. I mean, right, there's just hours and hours and hours, and I just keep going, covering every possible corner. Because I don't want you to feel the need to access other resources. It's not because I'm selfish. It's not because I think I have all the answers. It's not because, you know, I don't mean that from my perspective. I mean it from your perspective. Because people can become very confused. And the last thing you need right now is to be hearing different messages from different people of authority. You need a clear system, methodology, and message. And I encourage you to pick a mentor and stick with him or her, even if it's not me. Okay? If you like your counselor and feel that you're getting the right advice from her, then go with it. If Dobson's your guy, read all his books, you know? But you can't afford right now to, you've got enough to deal with. You can't afford to be feeling conflicted about different methods you're getting from different professionals, all of whom you're giving a lot of weight to because they're professionals of authority. And so pick your mentor. And if they're not covering something that you feel it's needed covered, then ask, you know, what is the answer to this question? You know, where do I get more resources along this line? Okay, let's go on.
Hi, Mort.
Hi there.
This is Lexi.
Okay, Lexi.
How are you?
Thank God, I'm doing well. The teleconference has actually energized me.
Good, I'm glad. I'm wondering if you've ever dealt with obstinate children. My boys, I'm very concerned that our two boys are going to be angry with me when this reconciliation becomes possible.
Yeah, sure. So the answer is yes. Now, do you want to ask a follow-up question about that?
Yes. They are 20 and almost 16. They really want nothing to do with him, and I don't know how to handle that.
Yeah, so this is a first marriage. This is their father.
This is their father. Yes, I do have a stepdaughter as well that I raised.
So a couple of points that I think you might find helpful. First of all, this is a great parenting opportunity. You have to realize. Actually, let me start somewhere else. And I'll come back to that. These are children. Even though one of them is 20 years old, okay, let's not call him a child. He's a young boy, a young adult. And the 16-year-old, I mean, come on, this is a teenager, okay? Now, think back and remember, you know, where you were at 20 years old, your level of maturity, your level of sophistication, you know, your level of life experience. What I'm trying to get at here is that you're the adult in the room. You are the parent. They are the child. And your responsibility here is to provide leadership in your family. You're not taking lead from your kids. They're kids. And you're the matriarch of the family, and you have to provide leadership. And so, you know, when it comes to, I don't mean to sound, you know, harsh when I say this, and you certainly should not speak to your children like this, but I'm just speaking this way just to be clear and quick. But when it comes to whether or not you choose to heal and reconcile with your husband and how you go about doing that and for how long, it makes absolutely no difference what your kids think. They're kids. They don't have the right to weigh in on such a topic. Now, again, if they were insisting on weighing in on such a topic, you should listen like a good parent. And you don't want to tell them what I just said. You don't have a right to weigh in. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I mean is you shouldn't give weight to – you shouldn't take advice, right, or counsel, marriage or family, from a 16-year-old or even a 20-year-old, especially one who is emotionally wrapped up in the fact that their father abandoned them or betrayed them or whatever. So that's my first point, is that, you know, our society has turned in a direction that, you know, families become democracies where kids have as much say often as parents. I think that's dysfunctional. I don't think it's healthy. It's not healthy for the parents. It's not healthy for the kids. It's not healthy for the family. A family is not a democracy. It's a monarchy. In my family, I'm the king. My wife is the queen. And by the way, I don't mean that like, you know, the king has more power than the queen. We are equals in the relationship. But we're not equal when it comes to my kids, even my adult kids. And so now is the time for you to exercise that leadership and to realize that, you know, you have important life decisions here to make. And what your 16-year-old thinks about those decisions is completely irrelevant. Don't tell him that, all right? I'm not looking for you to damage your relationship with him. But that's the truth. Okay, next point. Next point is you have a tremendous parenting opportunity here. And the parenting opportunity is to educate your children about what it means to honor their father. They don't have to like him. They don't have to love him. They're allowed to be upset and angry. And they don't have to spend a lot of time with him. But I think, you don't have to agree with me, but I believe that there are certain relationships in life, not many of them, but there are certain relationships in life that are unseverable. In other words, there are certain relationships where we have a moral obligation to engage in the relationship in a decent and respectful way. And I think our relationship with our mother and father is one of them. And you have the opportunity here. You know, in today's world, kids are growing up in a society where they too often see people writing each other off. And they think that that kind of behavior can apply to relationships like with their mother and father. And it's not right. And we have an obligation to jump in there and try to help educate them. You don't have to love them. You don't have to like them. You don't have to spend a lot of time with them. But I think that it would be a good idea to have some semblance of a relationship with him, and that relationship should be decent. It should be respectful. And by the way, you should do this, you should tell your sons. You should do this not because he deserves it, because you deserve it. In other words, God forbid you should become the kind of boy, or for the older one, God forbid you should become the kind of young man that doesn't speak to their father. It doesn't have a relationship with their father. It's not right. It's not good for you. And too often, I hope you can probably hear a theme here that arcs back to a portion of my answer to Lynn, right? The question here is not how he is treating them. The question here is, how are you going to raise them to treat him? That will have a much bigger impact on their character development, on their maturity, on their self-respect, and on their life than how he treats them. And so this is a great mothering opportunity, a great parenting opportunity for you to try to impart that to them. Also, the unintended consequence of all of this will be, this is not why you should do it, but the unintended consequence of all this will be that you'll win some points with your husband for trying to facilitate a healthy relationship between him and his boys. It's the right thing to do, and you should do it anyway. But it does offer the tactical advantage of you earning the respect and the trust and the goodwill of your husband in that regard. Okay, we went a little over, but I enjoyed it and hope you all benefited from it. Thank you all for your excellent questions. I know I didn't get to everybody and even close, but if you go to your login, you know, your online portal, and you click on the tab that says Solutions Library, there are about 150 questions and answers there. And I guarantee you that the people that I didn't get to, your question was probably asked and answered there. So it's an important resource. Anyway, thank you all for your excellent questions. I hope you found my responses helpful. Keep up the good work. Let me know what else I can do. Good night, everybody.